morning. This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQD 90.7 FM K-Squid, and streaming at ksqd.org. I'm Stephen E. Pop, and this is In the Garden. Joining me here is your host, Joe Truscott.
Hey,
good morning, Joe Truscott.
Hey, happy birthday, KSQD.
We are four years
old this weekend, and so proud to be here.
I'm always fascinated by inanimate objects having birthdays, but it's a good thing. It's a good thing, and trees have birthdays, too.
They sure do.
And I have often found myself in the position of saying, what is wrong with my tree? And maybe some others are, too. And that brings us to our guest today. We are very, very pleased to have with us in the studio Albert Weisfuss, who is a certified arborist. He is a native of the Monterey Bay area and owner and founder of Monterey Bay Tree Works. And full disclosure, Albert and I have been friends for at least the last 30 years. I believe we met working for the City of Monterey Parks Division. Say good morning to our listeners, Al.
There you go.
Good morning, listeners.
There you go.
Good morning, Steve.
It's a voice made for radio, folks.
Absolutely. So, Al, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and your history, and how it is you came around to trees and being an arborist.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story. I was a machinist, actually, in San Jose, working indoors. Didn't like it too much. And came back down here and approached a utility company and said, hey, I need a job. And they said, you have some boots? And I said, yeah.
They said, that was the only prerequisite, boots.
Right? Are you afraid of heights?
They didn't ask him that. Yeah.
Two prerequisites. You have boots and can you start tomorrow? I said yes and yes. Went back up to San Jose, cleaned out my locker. Yeah. Came home, went to the store, bought a pair of boots, and showed up the next day.
Yeah. So you didn't even have the boots yet.
No. I kind of lied my way into it.
Way to roll there, Al. Yeah.
Not knowing, you know, here I am like 38 years later, still doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
still and doing that was it. That was working for utilities doing tree work.
Correct. Yeah. I was on a climb crew, and it was removals and trimming high voltage power lines for PG&E.
Gotcha.
So I did that a few years.
Gotcha.
Did you ever have those instances? And I don't know if this was true. We had a couple of big storms, and I think it was Prunedale, where they said the utility lines were attached to living trees.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever have any of that? It just seems so not right.
Yeah, and it's not in multiple different ways. But during my tenure with them, it was more just maintenance of the trees and making sure there was clearance and things like that. I run across that more now on the consulting end with people and clients. How do I get those lines moved off of my tree? Is it okay to be attached to the tree?
Now you bring up an interesting point, and that is that you were at that time with the utilities a tree worker, but there's a significant difference. And one of our listeners and colleagues, Suki Wessling, had this question: is that what really is the difference between a certified arborist, an arborist, or a tree worker, tree crew?
Right. There's going to be, you know, some differences. Some can be pretty significant. You know, the tree person might be the person that's going to just drive around and pass out cards, you know, put things in your mailbox.
Yeah, I get those quite regularly out in Prunedale. Yeah.
So that might just be the tree person, you know, that's trying to get established. And
so
get
that's
started.
A trimmer and a cutter and a faller.
I just bought a chainsaw, man, and I'm going to get my money's worth out of it.
Yeah.
And they're doing firewood on the side, no doubt.
You know, the tree arborist, the arborist is going to be somebody with more skills, more background, maybe running a company, things like that. The certified arborist, you know, there's going to be some requirements that they're going to have to meet to get that certification. You know, there's 10 categories.
Oh.
They're going to take an exam, you know, so they're going to take an exam. They have to have at least 3 years of full-time experience to qualify to take that exam.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have that experience already. 10 categories, can I list
those
off?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So you have tree biology, for mm-hmm. one. That's, you know, one of them. Tree identification. You have to know your tree.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
If you can't just walk up and think you're looking at a cypress and you're looking at a pine.
Or a cedar. Or yeah,
whatever.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Huh? Soil management.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a category.
Yeah.
Installation and establishment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where it really begins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your whole tree life begins when you purchase and establish that tree and plant it.
Right tree, right place sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Pruning, diagnosis and treatment, trees and construction.
Mm.
You know, I contract with municipalities now. I have City of Pacific Grove, City of Seaside. I'm their contract arborist.
Okay.
So there's a lot of construction management that comes into play there.
What's that mean, construction management?
So construction management would be like, you want to remodel your house, you want to do an extension, you want to build a house.
Uh-huh.
So municipalities require you to have a certified arborist come in and do a forestry management plan.
Mm.
What trees are on site, tree protection regarding trees that are going to remain,
uh-huh.
you know, which trees are going to come out, why are they going to come out, things like that. So you'll write a report to that municipality saying, here's what needs to come out. Here's what's going to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
how's it affect the flora and fauna if you're taking trees out?
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. So are you involved in environmental impact reports? I mean, do they come to you and say, what do I do?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes they do. Yeah, the homeowner might come in and say, look, I want to do this addition. But the municipality wants a full impact plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how's it affecting the drainage, you know, the heat indexes,
mm-hmm.
you know, winds, all of those kinds of things come into play.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Tree risk. I'm also a tree risk assessor qualified. So that's a whole nother exam that you have to take.
So each of these 10 categories has its own exam attached to it?
These are all part of one exam.
One exam, yeah. Okay, for your certification.
Correct. But what they have now is a tree risk assessor qualified. It's called TRAC. So that's a whole nother exam that you have to take to be able to go out and look at somebody's tree and tell them, what's the risk that's involved?
Right.
You know, and how
so
to treat
if you live on a hillside and right above you is a tree that seems to be leaning towards your house, mm-hmm. You can come in and tell them, I think you better take it down.
Or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not always just take the tree down.
Yeah. What's the target potential?
Exactly.
And,
because what's making that tree a high-risk tree that it needs to be removed? What might that be? Age, condition, health, things like that.
Right.
Half the roots are out.
That's another one, yeah.
The top is blown out. The branches are sagging.
Right,
the bark
is
peeling.
Right.
It's dead.
Those are all factors.
Yeah.
But the main factor is, what's the target?
Yeah.
If I have a tree that's out in the middle of nowhere,
right,
and it has all of those issues,
uh-huh.
bark falling off, branches breaking, top blown out, roots uprooting.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But it's in the middle of a field. It's a low risk.
Yeah, very low risk.
What's the problem?
You know,
right,
and plus those trees, and we call them snags in the Forest Service.
Exactly.
They are they're wildlife habitat.
Mm-hmm.
They provide a lot of good wildlife habitat. Yeah. So if you can leave them in place, that's a good thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And sometimes, if it's on your property, you can reduce the risk and leave a snag.
Yep.
You leave a snag for
that.
Other animals to come in and habitate. In that tree,
that's right.
Woodpeckers and raccoons and whatever.
That's our first little bit of jargon, folks who are listening. Snag.
Snag.
Please define snag.
Let's see.
A snag. I'll take a shot at it.
The
original concept of a snag, it might be a logging term from the Sierras
when I lived up there. Yeah.
That it was a tree that was dead. And that would hang you up. You could hang up another tree in it, or sometimes you had snags in lakes. You had underwater trees that had fallen in, and they would snag you from below the surface of the water. I'm making that up.
No, but
you know, it sounds good.
It sounds good. Yeah, you got me going. Yeah, I'm like, oh, okay.
But
it's good and fair.
Basically speaking, a snag refers to a dead tree that is still upright and in place.
And the purpose is if you have property and it's not near your house or it's there for aesthetic reasons, you don't care about it, it can be out there. It actually is a very good thing to have in the wild.
So of all of these categories, then, it sounds like a number of them fall into my next question. Two questions, really, based on this is, when does someone want to, and you mentioned risk assessment, which is a great one, but when is the time for somebody to say, no, you know, I don't just need to call Fred's tree crew in here to, you know, hack and slash. I need to have a certified arborist on hand. Mm-hmm. And hand in hand with that question then is, what sorts of situations will a permit be required for tree work to be done, which I assume the regular tree worker is not authorized to write up. So certified arborist, then your job would be to go in and issue the permit if it were required or called for.
So what was the first part of that again?
So the first part was basically, when is the best time? When should somebody call you instead of Fred's tree crew?
Right. You know, that's a really good one, because to me, the best time to bring in your arborist is when you're going to plant your tree.
Ah.
Right? Because
start in the beginning.
You start at the beginning. Am I putting in the right tree in the right place, like we mentioned earlier, right? And how long is that tree going to be there? Some trees have a shorter lifespan than others.
Mm.
And when you talk to people, sometimes it's, you're not just planting that tree for your own enjoyment, but the next homeowner, your next family member.
Sure, next generation.
They're all going to be under that tree and enjoying it as well. So we look at those kinds of things. So for me, and I try and do a lot of young tree care.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important, to establish good branching networks, good rooting habitat, and is it the right tree? Is it going to grow into the right place?
Mm.
Right? It's going to get big in a little place? Not going to work.
Right, right.
So a lot of times people call you in after the fact. What's wrong with my tree?
Yeah.
It's dying. It's too big. You know, those kinds of things.
It's growing at a 45-degree angle because I planted it right along my garage.
Right, exactly. Yeah, roots are lifting up my house now.
The sidewalk is gone.
So how do I mitigate those problems, you know? That's when they'll call me in. Usually the arborist gets brought in after the fact.
So in the perfect world, they would be calling you ahead of time to say, hey, Al, I need some advice on, I want to plant some trees around my house or along the street or something like that.
Right.
What would you recommend?
Right.
So give us an example or two of what would be a good tree to potentially have closer to the house, because I know that if we have a certain amount of foliage around our homes, we're going to break the wind, reduce, you know, the wind flow. We can create shade to keep our homes cooler.
Mm-hmm.
What are some good examples of a tree for close to a house, or what's not a good example, and equally for, say, a street tree?
Yeah, you know, there's no perfect tree for any situation. I mean, if that were the case, I'd be on the beach drinking Mai Tai someplace right now. If I had the perfect tree, I'd be doing that. So really, every situation is going to be different.
Okay.
You're going to look at your situation. What kind of tree is going to go in that soil type or in that environment?
So lots
where you're
of
living.
Other factors.
Yeah, there's lots of things going on. A good tree, probably, if I'm planting on the southern side of my house, I'm going to want something probably deciduous.
Okay.
So I get a little more light on my house. You know, something, if it's a small, narrow strip, something that's going to stay maybe under 30 feet, 25 feet, not real aggressive. And make if I'm planting where there's a lot of hardscape, I'm just going to have to accept the fact that there's going to be some damage at some point.
Some potential interface it's with just, roots and,
yeah,
and
just,
that sort
it
of
just
thing.
Happens. So mm-hmm. the idea situation then is knowing that you're going to do some root pruning. You can root prune when the roots are smaller, the tree is younger, tree is still healthy.
In the ground, a in tree ground. That's in the ground. How would you approach yes. that?
Well, you're going to look at the situation again. Mm-hmm. You're not going to want to prune too much at one time, too close to the trunk. You're going to assess the condition and the health of the tree.
Okay.
So there's a rule of thumb that you want, ideally on a mature tree, it's about four times the diameter of the trunk
okay.
for root pruning.
That's at breast height?
At DBH.
Yeah, DBH. Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. I didn't get it.
Okay.
We're going to go over this one more
Let's
time.
No, that's
this.
Okay. Yeah. And if I get off track, just guide me back.
So we're talking about the diameter of the trunk.
Correct.
And at breast height, DBH.
Yeah. And they've actually changed that, and I'm drawing a blank on the on
the
correct
the new term.
Yeah, but it's about 54 inches above grade.
Okay.
So you're measuring about
So
there.
What's the diameter at about this height? I'm putting my hands up next to my chest, folks.
Yeah. All right.
You can't see that on the radio? Oh,
okay. And that tells us what?
That will tell you the diameter of the tree. So the diameter is measured around the tree. So let's say you have a 10-inch diameter tree.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And you want to do some root pruning because you have some sidewalk damage.
Right, right.
Four times that's going to be 40 inches out from there is where they say it's safe to do some pruning.
So it's not necessarily the drip line of
well,
the tree.
Well, ideally, in the perfect world, you want to be out past the drip line.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
then we start working our way back in. You run across this a lot on construction
mm-hmm.
where people are doing additions.
Oh, sure,
and like
right.
that. And
they've got
to
protect the oak
here.
Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly. Yeah.
How much root pruning can I do here? You know, things like that. So we start out at the drip line and pass that. That's the perfect world. Start working your way back in. Now I'm at that, you know, four times the diameter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can still do some pruning. I don't want to cut anything big, anchoring, buttressing roots that are supporting the tree. I try to avoid those. Smaller roots, done nice and clean cuts, typically will compartmentalize. And maybe you'll get some adventitious rooting going on around there.
And how is that accomplished? I mean, are you going around in a circle with a spade, cutting
no,
through
it's
the
all
roots?
Done
or,
with, yeah, ideally,
with
loppers,
saw?
Hand
okay.
saw, things like that. No heavy equipment. That's a big problem on construction sites because two things. That upper 12 to 18 inches of soil, that's where all the really working roots are.
Mm.
The real vital parts of the roots that are exchanging.
Of a tree that's 50 feet tall.
Exactly, right? Because those roots, are the little tiny guys are the powerhouse. They are taking in nutrients, water, oxygen. They're working. They're exchanging everything. Below that are more buttressing, supporting roots.
Mm-hmm.
They're working too, but they're more of a supporting part. So when you come across the contractor that's come in and graded, you know, and leveled off to build, well, I only went down about 10 inches. What you're not understanding is that's the workhorse of the tree.
Took out all the life source of
that
tree.
So then they build the house, and the homeowner is loving their house and their tree.
Yeah.
And 5 to 10 years later, what happened to my tree?
Or less.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and it's true. I know with our local oak species, the coast live oak, Quercus agrifolia, they're very resentful of having grade changes. So they don't want to have soil piled up on one side of the trunk. And I've seen situations where the requirement was to create almost like a well around these trees if there was going to be a change of grade to maintain the original grade, whether that was a slope or a flat surface. Is that the sort of thing that you also get involved with the contractors in?
And, you know, I try not to create a bowl. You know, some will raise grade around them and build retainers and everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you have proper drainage
right.
to drain out of that little bowl that you've created, okay.
Yeah.
You know, ideally, our tree protection wants to be out to the drip line at least. But how often do you see the 2x4s in the orange netting just wrapped around the trunk?
Yeah. Yeah, right? All the time. Yeah,
yeah, and that's what it's only protecting the trunk in reality. Yeah, that's it.
Not
yeah.
thinking about the root system.
Right. Yeah.
So the a lot of the trees. I live in a neighborhood in North Salinas, and established 70 years ago, and they had planted along some streets camphor trees, mm-hmm. and then they planted Modesto ash. And then most recently, like in the last 40 years, liquid amber trees. And I'll tell you, I got problems with camphor trees, Modesto ash, and liquid amber, sweet gum. They have lifted up, created huge mounds around their bases.
Right.
And somebody said, with my liquid amber, said, oh, Joe, just get a tree service in here and grind those roots, because the roots are up on the lawn now.
Right, they're
doing wonders to the guys that cut the grass, but they're lawnmowers because they're hitting roots all the time.
Right.
Is that at all advisable? I mean, is that something you can do?
It's really going to depend on your situation. You know, how long has the tree been there? You know, we've had I have had some situations where, you know, we do a full assessment of the tree. Can I prune these roots and still have a safe tree, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's got big target areas. There's definitely times when the answer is no, and you have to take out a tree which looks pretty healthy, but it's just outgrown its location.
Mm-hmm.
The key here is putting in another tree. It's amazing how many people get that big 90-foot tree out of their yard and don't want to put another tree back in.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key, is putting more trees back in. You have to replant. Not with a lemon tree or a peach tree or something like that. Something significant.
Purple leaf plum. They're all in bloom all over Salinas
now.
Harmless little things.
But, you know, your liquid ambers in the early 90s, that was like the big street tree.
Outside the studio here. Yeah, we have some beautiful specimens
here. Yeah.
And very shortly after that, they went on the do not plant list for sidewalks because they were just eating everything alive.
Yeah. You know my neighborhood and you've never even been there. It's a challenge because I like the trees and I had a beautiful shape, but then the city hired a tree service thing to prune the trees, which they do about every 2 years or so. Mm-hmm. This time it's the Serengeti Plain. You're looking at nothing the high canopy, which is kind of hard to pick the fruit from the plum tree, but it's way up high now. They didn't do anything to the root system. They just cut off the top part of it. So there's got to be a rebirth at some point, right?
Well, there is. There is. You know, and they're being a deciduous tree. They're pretty adventitious. They're pretty forgiving for heavy pruning. Heavy pruning can create some problems. Liquid ambers tend to be pretty brittle.
Yeah.
Their branches break off, they'll split off, you know, and drop something down on the ground. For me personally, certain trees don't want to be raised way up high or thinned out really heavily because they just sprout back out. And you're just paying money to keep doing it over and over and over.
Yeah.
Trees like liquid ambers, since they're known to have brittle branch, you know, structure, it's better to reduce them down than keep raising them and thinning them out. Now, when you were saying that they raised them way up, maybe they had to get, I don't know how high up was, but maybe they needed to get some clearance for streets, vehicle traffic, or things like that. But when you were talking about connecting pruning with the roots, there's a couple of things that happen there. When you just raise a tree way up high, you're changing the leverage for wind.
Uh-huh.
And wind tends to, you know, having that canopy way up high, the wind tends to want to blow that tree over a little easier because the leverage is way up there. So part of that is reducing that way down. The other part of the connection with the roots, When you're cutting the canopy back like that, when you're reducing that canopy, there's a chemical that takes place at bud break. Hmm. And when the buds break and the leaves start to form, it sends a signal to the roots that says, hey, I need to grow. I need more food. I need more water. Mm-hmm. I need more oxygen because mm-hmm. we're growing. Mm-hmm. So roots start to grow. So in theory, when you're reducing that canopy down like that, you're removing a lot of that bud break. Mm-hmm. And it tends to slow down a little bit the expansion of root mass. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of slowing down that process of
check and balance process.
Kind of, yeah, you're kind of slowing down that process of tearing up your sidewalks and stuff.
Right. And yeah. And so the in a situation where you've planted trees, what's the fertilization part of it? How do you uh-huh. feed them something when they don't really have an established root system? I mean, you dug a hole, you plopped whatever it is from right. the nursery into the hole, yeah, and that's yeah, not yeah. an established yeah. root system. But
yeah. Are we still talking about in the sidewalks or just in your yard?
No, in your yard. You okay. planted a tree. Yeah, yeah. You planted a nice right. shade tree.
Right, right. Here's my advice to my clients. When I'm talking to them and we're looking at the condition of their tree, it's hardly ever just one thing. It's usually a multiple of things. Typically, it's the age of the tree. We've been in a catastrophic drought. Uh-huh. You know, insects are going crazy right now. So it's usually a multiple of things. When they start talking about, let's fertilize my tree, right? For me, first thing I say to them is, let's look at your yard. Everything looks really good except your tree. Mm. Do you think it's fertilizing? Do you think it's nutrient problem in the soil? Mm-hmm. If you have a turf really close by, I'll ask them, is your turf on a fertilized program?
Oh, yeah.
Because your tree roots are probably in there enjoying that fertilizer, right?
Yeah.
So for me, as soon as my client says, I think I need to fertilize my tree, let's look at the situation around me. First thing I'm going to do, if there really maybe a need to do that, I'm going to start pulling soil samples.
Okay.
Because
yeah.
I need to know, what am I fertilizing with?
Yeah, yeah.
Do I just need nitrogen or potassium mm-hmm. or whatever, right? Because mm-hmm. I don't want to start adding things that's already abundant in the soil.
Yeah.
So we'll pull soil samples and send it out. Comes back. Now we know exactly where our pH levels are, everything is yeah. with our soils. Now we know where to go with it. Most of the time, it doesn't need to be fertilized. It's so, got some other problems.
Summing up there is that if something is working, don't fix it.
Right.
Yes. We're gonna take a short break.
Gosh,
here.
Are we already there?
We are there.
I haven't even started with my questions.
We have a lot of questions when we come back here, and we'll be doing that in just a moment. We'll be right back. This is In the Garden with Stephen Popp and Joe Truscott, and our guest today, Albert Weisfuss, certified arborist on the Monterey Bay. And Joe, you had a question.
We want to get right back into this. My sister had a cherry tree in the middle of her lawn, and her stepson had a gardening service and always used weed and feed lawn fertilizer. And I said, the reason why your tree died is because those kinds of herbicides in the weed part of it are meant for broadleaf plants. Mm-hmm. And a cherry tree is a broadleaf plant.
Yeah.
Is that true, or did I make up something really good?
No, that is true. That's very true. And, you know, herbicides, you know, leave that to the guys that really know what they're doing, you know. And I have a pest advisor that I work closely with, and I'm pretty good at telling you what's on your tree. I don't tell you how to treat it. I bring him in, and he'll say, hey, here's what we're going to do.
And so folks know that's a PAC, a pest advisor consultant, and these are the individuals who can write you a prescription for what it is you need to do, whether it's a household situation or an entire farm.
But essentially, any off-the-shelf, big-box store, weed and feed, lawn fertilizer is not going to be good for any plants that are near that spread, right?
Well,
and that includes trees, because under the lawn are the tree roots.
Exactly, yeah.
We'll get them eventually.
All right. Yep. Good advice from Joe Truscott in the past without knowing what.
You nailed it, Joe. You did a good job.
Yeah.
So we had a question from one of our regular listeners, Rick Becton. He has a tree. It's a pin oak, Quercus palustris, swamp oak, Spanish oak. And these things get to 60, 70 feet in height. They're native to the northwest, midwest and northeast regions. Beautiful red foliage. But he's got a double leader on this tree. And he's had an experience, a bad experience, apparently, with a Monterey cypress tree that had a double leader. He removed one of those leaders, and the tree died. So he's concerned about his pin oak. You know, can he do this successfully, and when would be the best time to do it?
Explain what a double leader is, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, so a double leader, so there's what they call X-current and D-current. X-current trees are going to be a single leader, you know, like a pine, like a Monterey pine is a good example of that, usually. One trunk that develops, one main trunk with
laterals. Sends out side branches, but it's clearly one trunk.
One stem, yeah. X-current would be something more multi-stemmed, kind of more of a rounded based shape tree from the base. I'm not real familiar with the pin oak.
Yeah, it's not a local tree.
Yeah, no. So I don't know if they are normally a standard single trunked tree. Do they develop more like birches, maybe, with multi-stems?
They get really tall, and they can be relatively long-lived, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, because, I mean, there are trees that's just their growth form. There's multi-stems, and that's just how they grow.
And if they have two, just let them have two.
You can, yeah. So sometimes what happens is, like, I'm going to use his cypress as an example.
Okay.
Sometimes they'll develop that double-stemmed, multi-leader, whatever term you want to choose to use for that. When they're small, and the diameter of each stem is still very small, 4 inches, 6 inches, whatever, they're separated. They're not touching each other. And as the tree grows and matures, the diameter, the girth of each of those stems gets bigger and round, and pretty soon they're side by side. And that's what they'll call included bark.
Ah, yes.
See? And so what happens is that two stems continue to move back and forth, and moisture, sands, debris, dirt gets down inside of there, and it'll start to cause a little decay.
Because it partially grows together, but it's still a weak bind, and the wind or whatever else will cause the friction in it,
right?
And that opens
up
the bark.
Rubbing. Yeah, it's just that constant movement, rubbing. So then some decay can set in there and create a weak attachment. And if it gets too big and too heavy, it's not properly monitored or managed, it can fail. You have trees right out in the front here. That's just their growth habit.
Yeah.
And they have these multi-stems and included bark. Included bark is not a terrible thing. You'll see that compartmentalization, that work around that seam where it's making new wood to support itself and make itself stronger. So sometimes, like on his cypress, we have to manage that. If he wants to make it into a central leader, a standard form, and the tree is young, he probably can get away with doing that.
Okay.
Yeah. More mature trees, they're already dependent on that amount of foliage that they have. If we take and cut a big section of tree off, we're taking a lot of foliage off. That's the food source. And we're putting a big wound in the tree.
Yeah.
This is going all the way back to our beginning conversation. Doing that kind of stuff when the tree is young and seeing that, I can go in my little hand pruners and just go snip.
Right.
And now I've got a standard single leader tree.
Right.
And that little area is going to compartmentalize, and we're golden. We're good.
So you bring up a good question here again regarding wounds, cut wounds on trees. Two schools of thought. One is that those wounds should be treated with some kind of patch or tar or sealant. And the other that says, no, don't do that. We're going to get negative pathogens sealed in. What's your feeling about it, or is it a case by case?
No. My feelings on that is you don't do that anymore. They've already given research to show it.
Sure.
Says how it doesn't work, you know. But I'm going to give you a really good example as why it doesn't work.
Oh.
So research is showing you that painting it, if your tools were infected, you're sealing in that infection that what is on your tools. But here's Here's a really good reason why we don't paint wounds. And a lot of people were painting wounds on Monterey pines. You're going to make your cut. I'm sorry about all this hand movement. I'm all over the place right
here.
The listening audience can't see your hands moving around.
They can't?
What? Wait a minute. So When you paint the wound on a pine tree, for example, that tree is on a good, healthy one. It's just going to push a ton of resin, and it's just going to push all that material right off because trees will compartmentalize, seal off their wounds naturally.
Sure.
So, you know, a pine is a good example.
Yeah.
It's just going to push it right off.
Lots of resin.
And most trees will push some kind of resin in there to seal that wound off.
Now, before we get off this topic, have you ever recommended some kind of bridge, a piece of wood that separates the two trunks, so that the joint part will have less friction
and can really get hard.
Actually, what you're probably going to be doing is just the opposite. You're going to put some kind of cabling, or even sometimes, which I've done myself too, on good healthy trees, you can bore through that area just above and put a big rod in there to keep it more stable. Because the idea is it's already there. That problem is already happening.
Circumferential, a cable around the trunk?
No. So you're gonna want to get in the upper two-thirds of that canopy.
Okay.
And you're going to put a cable up above. So a lot of companies are going to say, I'm not cabling because I'm acknowledging a problem with the tree. I'm not going to put a rod in there because I'm wounding the tree and I'm acknowledging there's a problem with the tree. Now we're into liabilities. This is back to your question earlier. What's the difference between the certified arborist and the tree guy? The certified arborist is looking out for the tree as well as the client. I've got a really nice tree. Can we mitigate the problem with correcting this pruning, cabling, rods, whatever, right?
So you would use cabling to then support large limbs to keep them from breaking out? Is that the idea?
Well, we're still kind of talking about the double stem.
Yeah. Okay.
So back to your question is, no, I'm not going to try to keep them apart. I want to keep them from failing. So 9 times out of 10, it's just going to be a nice cabling. A good cobra cable. It's remember the Chinese handcuffs where you put your fingers in. That's how a cobra system works. So you're not damaging the tree. The cobra system goes wraps around. You weave it in and out. And so the more, when the wind blows, the more tension that gets put on that cable system, the tighter it holds on. See?
Mm-hmm.
And, but what it allows is that when there's no winds blowing, there's no movement, it's relaxed, the system, the cable system is relaxed, so the tree can still grow in diameter. Where the old school days, we'd go in with the big aircraft cable, hardware, and you'd have to go back every couple of years and readjust everything.
Tighten them up.
Or loosen them, so the trunk is expanding. Hmm. So we would cable that now. So now the thing about cabling is it's not going to support it if it fails. That's still a possibility. The reasoning for cabling is to keep that one lateral that looks weaker than the more dominant one from blowing in the wind and getting beyond recovery.
Hmm.
See? So that cable pulls tight before that lateral gets beyond recovery and breaks off.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea right there. So to try and separate them, I've never seen it done. Maybe somebody's tried it. I don't know. But ideally, we're trying to keep it together versus separating it.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Now, so another – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
No, I was, again, warning that this could go off in six different directions at once. So let's say somebody wants to buy a specimen tree. They have a front yard, and they've got space around it, and right in the center of it, they want to plant a beautiful tree. What kind of recommendations? Where would you go? And we're talking about Central Coast here. So,
So do you mean like, when you say where would I go, do you mean like a nursery?
No. Uh-huh. What kind of tree?
What do you recommend people
look for
that
they're going to be satisfied and has all the things? It's got beautiful foliage. It's got a sturdy trunk. It's got
what's your favorite tree?
It's got it's got all kinds of other benefits. It doesn't it doesn't shed all the leaves. It's not a magnolia. It's not a, it's sort of like
it'll do your taxes for you.
And make coffee when you're up in the morning.
Talk to you, be a friend.
Actually, my trees and I, we talk all the time. So, you know, I just can't get them to make my coffee, though. That's the thing.
Not there yet.
Again, you know, here's what I say to my, if you came to me, Jones, and we're at your house and you said, I want to plant a tree here. What do you recommend?
Yeah.
The first thing I'm going to say to you is walk around your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. What's doing really good in your neighborhood right there? And which ones do you like? Mm-hmm. Jot down two or three that you really like. And then we can talk about what to put in there.
Okay.
That's how I would start our conversation. If you're like,
and Joe would say, I don't want what everyone else has.
Right. Yeah.
I want something special.
I don't like anything that they're growing. They're awful.
I want to be different.
I love going around the various communities and looking at trees and in the yard and say, my God, that's beautiful. Right. Do you know what it is? Knock, knock on the door.
I don't know.
It's been here forever.
Let me see.
Let me think about that. It's a tree.
It's a tree.
Yeah, that's what it was. It's a tree. Big pine. Big tree.
Yeah.
But, you know, after that, I mean, that's how I typically would start it off. But after that, we'll just have a conversation about what are you looking for? You know, what do you want a tree that gets really wide, really tall, flowers, deciduous? There's a bazillion options out there.
Keep going. All of those.
So we look at where you want to plant it, and we talk about what's going to grow in that spot.
Yeah.
Right. So then we start narrowing down our list. It's a process of elimination.
Okay. Joe, I think there's a magnolia in your future.
Yeah. I personally really like magnolias. I mean, there's a lot of different magnolias out there. Yes. So, and the other thing to me, trees with really, really big leaves are a whole lot easier to clean up than trees with little tiny leaves.
That's a good point.
All right.
So one of the questions I frequently get in my neck of the woods in Prunedale, where we have lots and lots of coast live oak, and the coast live oak, particularly when they're younger trees, have this habit of it almost looks like the trunk is splitting, going upright. And I always tell people, don't worry about that. That's natural. It's when they're splitting the other way that you want to think about it. So if they're splitting horizontally, might have an issue. If it's splitting upright, explain to our listeners what's going on.
Yeah. Most of the time, and you're right, that vertical and horizontal splitting, that's the big deciding factors right there. When you get into decay and pathogens and things like that, those fractures will start to make like little squares, kind of. You probably have seen that, you know. The vertical up and down fractures, probably 9 times out of 10, are more growth cracks.
Right.
So the trees just had a really, we're probably going to see a lot of that this coming next couple of years with all this rains that we just had.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, yeah, the tree is just super happy, and it's just busting loose, and it's growing faster than the bark can keep up with it. So it'll split the bark a little bit, and that's how you get these fissures, this rough bark in the oaks. So you can look at the oaks and see these big, long, deep, old fractures in the bark. I'll call them a fracture, or an indent, or what, however you want to call it. And you'll know that's from quite a while back, and the tree was really healthy. And you'll see the newer ones, which might just be a little, tiny little crack in the bark, which is okay.
But don't panic.
Don't panic. Yeah. If it's a crack, vertical crack, and it's in a seam, maybe where a couple of branches have joined together.
So is this your included bark again? Or
Oaks, you don't see a lot of the included bark on the oaks, okay. But sometimes, you know, where those branch collars come together and there's a little fracture in there, that's a little bit more concerning because one of those laterals maybe is starting to peel off a little bit. So those are things that you would be looking at.
While we're on the topic of oaks, what's the status on SODS, the sudden oak death syndrome?
Good question. And I don't know the exact status of where it's at. I know I did try and do some research here before coming here. And it, from what I sort of gathered, was that some areas are actually showing a decline.
Oh, good.
And part of that is due to climate change. And because it's more of a waterborne
pathogen.
And so heavy.
It's a phytophthora of some sort.
Phytophthora remora.
I've
got to look that one up.
Fungus, virus.
Fungus.
So I have to look that one up. So, you know, the little bit of reading that I was looking at was showing that their aerial surveillance that they have done is showing some decline, and they're sort of attributing that
a decline in the frequency, a decline in
the depth
vitality.
And I know that in the nursery industry, they've had a lot of restrictions on transporting material that could be host material for that outside of known areas of sods. So hopefully we are in a reduction. I remember when you and I were working together at the city in Monterey, the big thing then was pitch pine canker in the Monterey pine trees. That seems to almost not even be around anymore. Have the trees grown past that, or is that still a present?
You know,
it's always out there somewhere.
Yeah, I have my own thoughts on that. But yeah, I think a lot of that has sort of, the trees have kind of adapted and moved past that. It's still there. It's still a problem. And what's interesting about that, when it was first, pine pitch canker, we're going to lose all the trees on the peninsula. Everybody was panicking. So I started researching it. I started looking into it. And I found this great article in the library at Monterey and cypress pitch canker.
Oh, wow.
And this was like in the early 60s.
Ah.
And what was so interesting was the article was saying all the same thing.
Same thing.
No more cypress trees.
They're 17 all gone.
Mile drive is going to be devastated. we're not going to have any more.
Doom and gloom.
Yeah, and look, so cypress trees we still have pitch canker.
But in those 20 years I was working in Carmel, we lost magnificent trees.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous ones. Now, they were there were lots of studies and lots of things to do, and they were passing out new pine trees that were resistant.
Well, and therein lies part of the problem, that a lot of the reason we had such a difficulty with the Monterey pine was that they were produced as a Christmas tree species in New Zealand, where Monterey pine, Pinus radiata, faced all of about two pests, and here they have about 80 known pests and 100 and some odd pathogens that may affect them. So we had weakened trees being brought back in from New Zealand that weren't resistant.
Yeah.
And then with drought, you get the vector for pitch pine canker at that time was the bark beetles.
Right. So. But I've also seen some historic photographs of Carmel by the Sea and didn't have any trees.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
It was a coastline, like, you know, like Mendocino Coast.
Are you saying that we planted all those, Joe? We come in there, some contractor said, hey,
don't
man,
go you know, there because that's a whole another bag of worms. Subject.
Anyway,
terrascaping.
Well, I don't know, but we've had lots of interest in fruit trees as well. Mm. And is there anything special about growing fruit trees in a suburban yard? I mean,
I have a lot of calls on fruit trees.
Yeah,
I could come in and prune your fruit trees and make them grow good. Mm. But some fruit on latewood, some fruit on early wood.
Yeah, right.
I don't know which ones are which. So
2 year, 3 year spurs.
Right, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I tend to kind of defer those calls out to the people that know that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Because certain apples need pruning at a different time.
Right.
They produce fruit on different wood. You know, 1 year old wood, this year's wood, next year's wood.
Right.
Three year spurs, 2 year spurs.
I think it's like apricots or something you're pruning while they're still in leaf,
the reason there is gamosus. You don't ever want to prune an apricot tree during foggy or rainy weather.
Right.
You know, you want to have at least 5 dry days. So usually that's in the summertime and they're in leaf.
Right. So I mean, I kind of know some of the ins and outs of it, but my background has been for pruning is for structure, safety, you know, health. I can take really ugly trees and make them look really nice.
There you go.
But the fruit trees, I'd be scared of. I'm cutting off the fruit spurs or things like that.
What would be the first things that you would look at in a tree? Let's take Dubois Street here, right outside our window.
Right.
What were the things that just caught you? I mean, you're a tree junkie, so you can't keep your eyes out of the tree.
What
would you say?
I did see all the trees out in the front. I didn't look at them as to far as like, oh, I probably would prune that or do that. I think they looked pretty good.
Yeah.
You have a diversity of trees out there. That's always nice. Age differences is nice to have too. So,
would you have planted the white birch trees?
Yeah,
in the front?
Yeah, I like them. I think they're a good tree. Yeah, they tend to get some aphid problems, but you know that's manageable.
As we're getting close to wrap up time, I have to ask you the one question I always ask first time guests. Al, what is your first and earliest memory of gardening or plants?
Oh, that's kind of an easy one.
Good.
I was my first. I mean, I grew up doing gardening with my mom. I mean, I think everybody's done with their mom or their dad or something. I mean, my mom was an avid person to work out in the yard. And so I probably started, that's probably what got me going with it. But my first job as a gardener, I'm going to call myself, I was 14 years old. And I was working for a church. And it was just maintenance of the... You know, the flowers and the grass and things like that. So
perfect.
I've always worked outside, and that was it. Yeah.
Well, it looks like you've got a long career doing that ahead of you still. And, you know, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here today. We're going to have to wrap this up now, but hope to have you back again in the future.
Thanks so much
for coming in.
I'll be thinking of all kinds of questions now that you're gone and the show's over.
Yeah, right? Thank you so much, guys.